Siti Harman is executive chairman of Harman International. He's had and continues to have an absolutely remarkable career in many realms. He's been a college president. He founded a key program on technology, public policy, and human development at the Kennedy School. He's written extensively on subjects relating to business, business ethics, economics, public policy, quality of life, both articles and books. And, of course, he is, along with his wife, Jane, an extraordinary patron of the arts and someone who has contributed enormously to the vitality of the things that are going to be discussed this morning. And he's done that in many places. He's a trustee of the Aspen Institute. When he is in Washington, he has contributed to our cultural vibrancy there in many ways, and most recently, and we couldn't be more excited about this, the Harman Center for the Arts, which is going to be an extraordinary facility for not only the Shakespeare Theater that Michael Kahn directs, but many other performing arts groups from around the country. I had the privilege of taking a hard hat tour of it just a few weeks ago, and it is accurate to say it's going to be one of the most remarkable facilities for the performing arts anywhere in the world, given the architecture, design, and the thoughtfulness with which it has been developed. So everyone in our nation's capital and visitors to the nation's capital will benefit from that act of generosity for many, many, many decades. And in addition, here as a trustee of the Aspen Institute, he has just recently announced with fellow trustee Michael Eisner a very generous gift to establish the Harman Eisner Program in the Arts at the Aspen Institute, which has two dimensions, one of which is providing for artists in residence to join us in all of our programs and seminars and the Ideas Festival itself. Anna DeVere Smith is our inaugural Harman Eisner artist in residence. And it's also going to fund a fellowship program to bring leaders from the arts community, both performing artists and artists of all kinds, visual arts, performing arts, dramatic arts, musical arts, to Aspen for a series of seminars, and not just the artists, but also managers of the arts. So it's going to bring back to the Aspen Institute something that was very important at our founding. An understanding and appreciation of the arts, and not just qua the arts, but as a contributor to conversations about all other topics as well. So it is a particular delight to introduce Sidney, and I think we're all going to have a real treat this morning. Thank you very much.
I'm always reluctant to interrupt Elliot, if he is introducing me, and I wish he had determined not to make it so terribly brief. I would happily have spent another hour or two. By the way, I think it appropriate after three or four remarkably frenetic days to recognize how very much the glue this guy has been in this whole Ideas Festival. He, pretty much in the way the real work of a conductor takes place before the symphony appears and the crowd appears, Elliot's work was in the months before this week, and he's been all over this place, I think, in quite remarkable fashion. I grew up in a period when we were taught arts as decorative material, things that we turn to try to improve the appearance of other things. It was cosmetics. It had little meaning beyond that. In fact, the classes that I remember we took in arts appreciation were derided by all of us as arts depreciation. I've spent pretty much a lifetime becoming persuaded that the arts are fundamental, intrinsic, the material which permits us to reveal the universe, the planet, ourselves to ourselves, and that encouraging our kids in every constructive way to engage the arts, as nearly important, if you will, as mother's milk, is probably the most constructive thing we can do in the development of them as human beings and in the creation in them of some facility for critical thinking. I deplore the state of the arts in this country today. I will say a thing or two more about it as I introduce this quite distinguished panel, but I'm encouraged that here at Aspen, we are taking steps to make certain that the arts are treated not cosmetically, but as organically. I would think it useful at the outset to identify these three splendid fellows. Alan Fletcher, to the right, is here as the president and the chief executive officer of the Aspen Music Festival and School. And in the time that he has been here, that place is undergoing a simply stunning transformation. The work is vivid, the excitement is real. One can even hear a spoken word in the tent these days. Alan is marvelously well qualified for this role. He was head of school and music at Carnegie Mellon before he came here. Dr. Fletcher is a distinguished musician who has studied over the years with some of the world's great composers, and he will make his contribution to our contemplation, I know, quickly and meaningfully. This guy, Dana Gioia, is who I want to be when I grow up. Think of it. He is a former high executive in industry. He quit it to write poetry and other really revealing material. His seminal essay, published interestingly by The Atlantic, I think, in 1991, "Can Poetry Matter?" is for me the most consequential expression of the material we're talking about that I have read in this part of the century. Dana is in the remarkable role today, as I'm sure you know, the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. In his time there, and this is something I pay some attention to, in his time there, he has taken a virtually moribund organization, living virtually on borrowed oxygen, and revivified it. Think of it. The National Endowment for the Arts has a budget of less than $125 million for 300 million people. I think that's a shame. And I think it's stunning that he has, on that paltry sum, given this place energy and life and promise. I look forward to what he has to say. And here is my partner. Michael Kahn did not introduce me to Shakespeare. I was, it is widely held among my kids and grandkids, in school with Will in the short period of time that he spent in school. So I knew him and I knew his work and I adored his work before I met the maestro. But here is the quintessential expression of Shakespeare. He has been, for decades, the artistic director of the Shakespeare Theater. And we discovered each other in a special way a few years ago. Jane, I, and Michael were talking. When Jane, I, and Michael are talking, it means there are three people talking simultaneously. I spoke my wish to expand the Shakespeare Theater Company in Washington, which I tell you is likely the best Shakespeare Theater Company in the Western world today, to expand it to borrow from the rich, rich legacy of Shakespeare and reach out beyond Shakespeare to the work of others. Now, of course, he's done everything from Aeschylus to Wilde to Tennessee Williams, not Shakespeare alone. But said I to him, convinced that was a brilliant inspiration, I would like an art center in Washington that embraced Shakespeare but encouraged the remarkably creative new work that is available and terribly underfunded in poetry, in music, in dance, in recitation. I told him that I remembered years ago at the 92nd Street Y in New York, listening to four fabulous artists reciting Boccaccio's Don Juan in Hell. They appeared as we are here. I was transfixed. No scenery, no nothing, just the recitation by fabulous performers of a stunning piece of work. I wanted to encourage that kind of work also. Michael said to me, in effect, he was less generous than this. He said, Sonny, don't think it's your idea. That's an idea I've embraced all my life. That gave birth to the new Performing Arts Center that Elliot spoke about. Michael is its artistic director. He is its core. And finally, I would say, over the years, the most wonderful thing he has done, inspired, I am convinced, originally by the glorious work of Joseph Papp in Central Park in New York, at the Carter Center Barron, at the Carter Barron Center in Washington, he has presented Shakespeare and other great stuff free over the years in a wonderful amphitheater. And the kids come, and you know that audience is there for only one reason. They love this stuff. A quick introduction, and then I would turn to the panel. I have a couple of nasty questions for them. And after they, having ignored my questions and told you, as panelists always do, what it is they came here to say, we'll turn to you for your questions. My observation about the arts as organic has really informed the way in which I have thought about and conducted business. This place really was inspired by industry. The Pepke family, you were in a building named for Walter Pepke. The Pepke family came here to Aspen, 1949-1950, to what was a virtually abandoned, moribund old mining town, to do a celebration of the 200th anniversary of the birth of that remarkable polymath, Johann Goethe. Goethe was a stunning figure to contemplate. An artist, an architect, a musician, a playwright, a man whose work covered all of the arts, and a great humanist and a superb family man. His legacy inspired the Pepke family. This place began with a series of concerts, seminars, Aspen-like. It gave birth to the Institute just 50-odd years ago. And it seems altogether appropriate that that which inspired the Institute, this engagement and concern with the arts, should continue to inspire the Institute, thus the new program that Michael Eisen and I have introduced with the support of the board and others here at the Institute. So I turn to the panel and ask them, is my concern about arts in America, is my concern that we're headed, if we are not careful, for a kind of cultural bankruptcy in which nobody teaches, nobody learns. Our kids know only that which is lip-synced. Is that excessive? Is it valid? And if it is, what should we be doing about it? I'll start with you, Al.
Well, Renee Fleming wrote an essay just recently saying that she was not worried about the future of music in America in terms of the performers, because we see, and we certainly see in Aspen, extraordinary talent and preparation and discipline. But what we're all concerned about is the audience and the support in that sense for the arts. I completely agree with Sydney in so many ways, but one of them is that in the past 20 years or so, we've been making and supporting an argument in favor of the arts, which is an instrumental argument. We should support the arts because they're an economic engine. The arts bring in tourism, they bring in business, they attract talent to a city. And that's an important argument. And certainly all of us in Aspen are keenly aware that the Institute and the music and the ballet, the summer engine now equals or even perhaps surpasses the winter for the economy of Aspen. But the instrumental argument, I think, is not the argument to make, and it is instead, and I think this is what Sydney is saying about organic, it's the intrinsic argument. We must have the arts, not because of their utility in some business sense, but because they're an intrinsic part of who we are and the nature of society. And there's a growing body of research that suggests, I'll speak just for music here, but that suggests that the impulse to music coexists with the impulse to language. And I'll end with something that maybe Michael will want to take up. Jacques Attali wrote some years ago that music and theater had their origins in ritual sacrifice, and that the performer was a what would be the word was stepping into the role of the sacrificial victim.
It never was.
But something else that I pick up in what Sydney said in his introduction is music also has its origin in the impulse to sing to a baby. And the mother instinctively uses music to communicate with a child. So I do think the arts are intrinsic, and we must nurture them.
Thank you. Dana, I don't think it an accident or a coincidence that the Institute and you were born in the same year. I'm reminded that, speaking of Jackson Pollock, that Kerning had said, Pollock breaks ice. I think it's fair to say that Shakespeare broke ice, that Einstein broke ice, that Pollock broke ice, that all the truly great creative artists in their time, in their own form, broke ice. Would you, as a panelist, comment on that, or would you take the privilege that every panelist, including Sydney, has always taken in these affairs, ignore the question and say what you want to say?
Well, let me answer the question, but first offer a small disruption, inspired by you. You mentioned something that I had forgotten. I knew it once, but the conference was founded in honor of Goethe. And if we're in the mountaintops, in an institute created honoring Goethe, talking about high culture, let's quote some Goethe.
There you go.
Über allen Gipfeln ist Ruhe. Durch allen Wipfeln spürst du kaum einem Hauch. Die Vöglein schweigen im Walde. Warte nur, balde, ruhest du auch. Over the tops of the mountains is peace. Through the tops of the trees you hear hardly a breeze, and the small birds are quiet in the wood. Wait soon. You will find peace too.
Oh, that's lovely.
I think that there's something that's really fundamental about the arts that isn't particularly well understood nowadays, is that there are different ways of understanding and expressing the world. One of them we know very well. We talk about it all the time at Aspen, which is technology and science, where you can reduce everything to mathematics or cellular structure or whatever. This kind of understanding allows us to profoundly look into the workings of nature, to do all kinds of extraordinary things, from building bridges to curing diseases. We have the language of analytical, conceptual thought. Most of our educational system tries to train us in clear, analytical, conceptual thought, which is to, in a sense, scrape words down to their essential meanings and use them in a rational way. The language of politics at its best uses this, probably not often enough, but it's the language of sociology, of economics, of things like this. But there's another way of understanding the world and articulating the world, which I'll use the Greek term poesis, poetry, art. And this is a way which recognizes that as we go through life, as we experience life, we do not separate our ideas from our emotions, from our physical senses, from our intuition, from our imagination, from our memory. It's a way of saying that we respond to it with the fullness of our humanity. And when we talk to each other, the tone we use, the way we sit, look at each other, whether we're making eye contact or not, it's all part of the meaning that we're expressing to one another. So in a funny way, the language we use most in our lives to express our lives, the way that we experience our life, is poetically, is experientially. And what art insists on is that poetry, art, is not science for the feeble-minded. You know, it's not conceptual thought for the inept, but it's an independent and irreplaceable way of knowing the world. If you don't train people in a sense, understanding, developing, and using this, you're giving people the power of technology, the power essentially of politics, without the depth, refinement, and enhancement of their humanity. And what I worry about on a broad level in the United States is we have, and let's be middle-aged and blame the kids, that we have a new generation coming to maturity, which we have, as adults, have let down, because we have not made this not only part of their education, but part of the media and part of their culture. And so I have the ironic job of being the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, the official representative of the United States government for arts and arts education, in a society, and I wouldn't say just the government, but in a society which really doesn't understand or value the arts. And I think that's the root dilemma, that if it's not about we can pass a single law, an enlightened congresswoman could introduce a bill that would save us all. It's we have to make a fundamental maturation, development, transformation of our culture to do this. So I couldn't agree with you more profoundly.
I find it's often, I mean, I suppose we all do panels like this a lot. And one of the things, I always come away feeling, oh, isn't it wonderful that people actually get it? And then I think we're all preaching to the choir most of the time, and it's not really you that we should be talking to. And it's a false hope that when we leave Aspen that things are going to change because you've actually come here because you're already there. It's a little joke I make, but this has been a problem. The arts have never been valued in America, ever. And it's a little joke I make is that the wrong people got off the Mayflower. They should have kept on going. I'm not joking. These were people who came here because they thought that the arts were the devil's work. They thought dancing and singing was bad. And we've really had, you know, all of these years to sort of deal with basically a Puritan mentality that we never really have been able to get away from, and which, as a matter of fact, has resurged itself in quite large ways. I remember I had to speak to a group of Asian and Eastern European theater people, and they wanted to, I was told, the State Department called me and said, would you give them the history of the American theater? And I, but I thought, all right, I'll do a little homework, because I'd forgotten quite a lot about the history of the American theater. And in reading, I realized it was a really interesting fact that the very first theater in America was in Williamsburg, Virginia, and it was only allowed to be because it was called an educational experience. It was held in a schoolroom. And we have never really gotten away from this problem of having to apologize for having the arts. We've had to call it either an educational tool, an economic tool. We have never really ever accepted in this country that indeed arts were part of our life as a whole. Now, I think it got worse I think it got worse. I think the arts suffered hugely during the McCarthy period, when it was very easy to pick out political writers, political artists, political playwrights. We've never had any serious political playwriting since the McCarthy period that you can speak of. And since the rise of conservative fundamentalism in this country, where the arts actually became a stalking horse, I think, for a lot of other things, actually, quite frankly. The arts actually became, for much of the country, and I think Dane has been really terrific about this, I think the arts have become, for much of the country, the enemy. And it's very odd to be in a country where something that is intrinsic to your life, if you knew it, was the enemy. I mean, I used to want the Cold War to come back because it was better to have an external enemy to raise money on than an internal enemy, which became the arts. So this conversation that we're having here to convince ourselves that the arts are how we actually in many ways express ourselves, and quite frankly, we are surrounded by art all the time, whether it is, you know, the funny title of this panel, which is called High Art, a word I never use, or whether it is design, or the way the stop sign looks, or the way a house looks, or the way somebody has planted a garden, which is an aesthetic a response, and therefore an artistic response, we are surrounded and we behave in ourselves in a way like artists, not like professional artists, not necessarily like skilled artists, but as aesthetic beings. But what are we going to do to have this kind of a town hall in a place where we are the enemy, not where we are the friend?
May I just jump in with a funny story? Some 32 years ago, my mother and I went to a production in the McCarter Theater, which I believe was Michael's, of Tis Pity, She's a Whore. And it was a very steamy production, if I'm remembering it correctly.
In Section 9?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
My gosh.
And at the conclusion of the play, my mother, who was a great church lady and sort of a DAR person, said, "Well, you see what Oliver Cromwell was about."
I wasn't run out of town, but
at least you knew who Cromwell was, though. You know?
And it was, by the way, just it was a play that had been performed at the Royal Shakespeare Company in a subsidized theater in England. And it was done in a theater in Princeton and caused havoc. That's because...
Why are you looking at me? I think my job is to stay the hell out of the way here. Let you guys... offer your wisdom. I did threaten you with a question, and I'm going to put it to you so that we have time for friends to ask questions or to disguise guidance in the form of a question. The one thing that at the outset, when I made reference to the giants, to Shakespeare, to Picasso, to Pollock, to Einstein, two things they had in common. The first time their work appeared, it was dismissed by all the critics as ugly. The second thing they had in common is that in his own way, each of them did himself and prompt us to rejigger the way in which we saw the relationships of things and in reality. They took what we thought to be observed reality, presented it to us in a totally different way, which revealed the universe, the planet, ourselves to ourselves. That's no small thing. And poets, as artists, have a way of thinking in patterns, as distinguished from linear and sequential thinking, that I, as a businessman, value enormously. And so I really am never joking when I argue, get me some poets as managers. Here's the question I put to these fellows, and I'm not going to let Dana Joya sit up here and be the only one who recites poetry. here's an epigram from Albert Camus. A man's life work is nothing less than this slow trek to rediscover through the detours of art those two or three simple but glorious images in whose presence his heart first opened. I turn to each of the panelists. Tell us of the one or two simple but glorious images in whose presence your heart first opened.
Such a beautiful question. When I was a tiny kid, my mother was a musician as well as a censor. I began singing the St. Matthew Passion, starting as a boy in the boy choir, and then moving as my voice changed, and then becoming a musician in the band, because she was producing a St. Matthew Passion every year. And that work, to me, is the image of all art. And I feel there's a remarkable thing that happened in some of the camps in World War II, is that the musicians were able to write down from memory vast amounts of work and thus feel as though they were preserving the memory of the species in that way. And I feel as though I could write down the St. Matthew Passion note for note.
Thank you.
My mother was probably sociologically about as far away from your mother as possible. She was the daughter of Mexican immigrants, working class, never had much education. But she loved poetry. And she had been educated in the public school system at a time when they still made people memorize poems. And her own father had liked poetry, who was a vaquero. And so she had all these poems by heart. And I think my earliest awakening in a ugly, poor neighborhood in Los Angeles to what art was just to hear my mother recite these things. For years, I didn't understand that sometimes by reciting them, she was telling me something about her life she couldn't tell me directly. She was expressing the sorrows of her life in a way. But the poem of hers that I remember most vividly, her reciting, was Annabel Lee. And so, I just hear, it was many and many a year ago in the kingdom by the sea that a maiden there lived whom you may know by the name of Annabel Lee. And that maiden she lived with no other thought than to love and be loved by me. I was a child and she was a child in this kingdom by the sea. And we loved with a love that was more than a love, I and my Annabel Lee, a love that the winged seraphs of heaven coveted her and me. And this opened up, and this is in the Camus quote is, I think, so relevant to this, opened up a kind of hunger on one hand and an awareness on the other that I didn't, probably took me 20, 30 years to understand where it was. But I realized right away, this sounds very much like a gay narrative, how at an early age I realized I was different from the other boys. It wasn't that I was gay, it was just that beauty kind of stopped me dead in my tracks. I mean, the nun would play a record of Chopin, and everybody else would be poking each other with pencils, and I would just be there like... And so I knew that I wanted to go wherever this stuff was. There was no signpost in my neighborhood. There was nobody who had gone to college or did this. But I sort of, and so I, in my own way, I kind of groped over the next 10, 15 years, largely through music. Which is the only art that the poor are offered training in this country. Before I sort of became first a musician, I wanted to be a composer, and then I eventually became a poet. But it seems to me it's that awakening to the full potential of what your life might be beyond the possibilities your own family, your own class, your own race, your own neighborhood gives you, which is one of the great human gifts that art affords. And if I'm trying to do anything at the National Endowment for the Arts, it's to make those moments available to millions of kids who do not have them offered on the media, in their schools, in their daily lives.
And that would lead to the real discussion about the future of the arts in the country, which is arts and education, without a change in policy and without a change in the way we see education, at least in terms of the arts, we would not have arts in the future. But since we're talking about narratives about mothers, I was going to say that the moment of revelation for me was going to see Martha Graham for the first time with telling a myth and with Noguchi sculptures, and all of a sudden the idea of metaphor and myth hit me. But I had a Russian immigrant mother who was pretty much self-taught, and she had read a book called Tree Grows in Brooklyn. And in that book, the mother, the Irish immigrant mother, reads to her daughter every night. And my mother and my father worked, and my mother didn't get home till about 7 o'clock. But she would read to me before I went to bed. And she read Shakespeare to me, not Charles and Mary Lamb, but Shakespeare, all of Shakespeare. And then she read me all of the Bible. And I make a joke about it, but she knew there were kind of dirty parts in the Bible. So we didn't have Song of Solomon, and we cut out all the begats. But, but my mother was so clear that there couldn't be anything like that in Shakespeare, that we got all of Shakespeare. And I think I was smart enough to know that there was some pretty racy stuff going on. But what happened to me was that I heard words. I didn't understand it. When people say to me, I don't like Shakespeare because I don't understand it all, how could I have understood it at 6? I didn't. Of course I didn't understand it at 6. And I suspect my mother didn't completely understand it at 6. She didn't read footnotes. But the story, the images, and the language coming to me for the first time embedded itself in me to love those things and be curious about a lot of things. Not just because I ended up wanting to be a director at the age of 5, but because I became really interested in literature. I began to read. I was interested in history. I began to want to know about the places and the times that were in these stories that I was being told. And that, I think, is what is important in giving arts to young people. It's not about making dancers and painters and musicians, which is what people rather short-sightedly think that this is. It's about creating people who think and who interact socially in a different way. If you are in a band, what do you have to do? You have to work with someone else. You have to have rhythm together. You have to become an ensemble. You develop a sense of comradeship and at something that you are working together. If you are painting, you have to see things in a particular way, and you express your imagination. If you're in a play, you learn discipline. You learn self-discipline, because you have to learn the words. You have to come to rehearsal. And more than that, arts allow young people to use their imagination in a way that we think is acceptable. Otherwise, we call it daydreaming, and we inhibit that in children. We think that that's a waste of time. Now, how are we going to have great, when this country thought that really, we had the science gap, and so we really had to just teach science and mathematics. How are we going to have great scientists? How are we going to have great leaders if they're not at an early age taught to think outside of what exists? How is anybody going to be innovative if they are not allowed to dream about what's not there? How are we going to have a social body if we do not learn how to get along and deal with people who are different from us, which you have to do if you are in an after-school program with a band or with a play? So, and then teaching people how to look at art and poetry in a way that excites them. At a young age. And that, it seems to me, that's what everybody in this room should do. It's not about going to necessarily more concerts, although it'd be nice if you did, and took your kids, or more plays, but actually in your neighborhoods, in your towns, on your school boards, insist and find ways that arts have to come into the classroom. Now, one of the things that I think, of course, Dana has done it institutionally, and one of the things that I think I'm sure Alan does and we do, is that artists themselves are so aware, and arts institutions are so aware of the lack of this. In D.C., there just is none. There's none. I mean, we have a school. You have to walk in metal detectors to get into school, so nobody's worried about whether you're carrying a paintbrush or with you. Or a guitar pick, that art institutions themselves have gone into the schools and given of their time to bring arts because the administrations don't do it. But if you have any clout, that's what, if you want the arts to continue in America, that's where it has to be. And it's not about school board saying what's good art and what's bad art, what's right art and what's good art. It's art, and art will grow children in a very different way.
Let me close our comments by making this one observation. As the great proselytizer of jazz in America, Dana will take some comfort from the fact that I use jazz to teach management. That in contrast to the conventional approach to management, which is top-down, linear, synchronous, I turn in the times when I have an opportunity to influence the way our young developing managers grow, I call their attention to Wynton Marsalis, who, if he has an orchestra of 20 people, sits in the back. He's part of that crew. He doesn't conduct from up front. You have to go find him. What a message that communicates. I speak of the quartet, four geniuses, each of whom can play his, her instrument superbly. What is it that makes the magic of a Marsalis quartet? It's that they listen to each other and respond to each other. What a wonderful way to think about management and business. And by the way, not a bad way to think about democracy. Your questions to this august group, please.
I'm coming out all right. A little lengthy, but my question is pertaining to the performing arts. It's particularly directed at Dana Gioia, but also the three other gentlemen on the panel. Last night, you said to me that audiences were increasing in only three areas of the performing arts: opera, jazz, and musical theater. Why is that so is part one of my question. Part two of my question is, how can we increase the audiences to the other performing arts: classical music, ballet, dance, straight theater, including Shakespeare, dramas like O'Neill, comedies? I know one of the answers to that increase is education, but is there any other way we could increase it? So I'll repeat. One, why is the increase coming only in jazz, musical theater, and opera? And two, in the other areas of the performing arts, how can we increase those audiences?
Yeah, that's a big question. Let me see if I can do it really quickly. The main reason opera is increasing, and I think it's instructive, because they always say, well, one reason the arts aren't doing well is it's too expensive. There's no art more expensive than opera to produce or to buy a ticket to. It's largely because of surtitles. The average, you know, theater goer, classical music lover can now go into an opera without knowing Italian or German or French, and they can follow it in real time as drama. I think that's what's driving there. For jazz, I think it's a combination of very small things. Ken Burns' documentaries and the NEA's program. I want to get back to that, because I think that's part of the solution. Musical theater, it's largely because the Disney company has realized they can sort of market the experience of a movie in a kind of, pardon this, and I know you're a friend of Michael Eisner, a kind of fabricated, you know, sort of theatrical extravaganza. So it's a kind of, I think, a rather tame but extravagant kind of theater. All of the other arts are declining, some of them precipitously, and nowhere more precipitously than among the younger quintiles, 18 to 24, 25 to 34, the scariest of which is dance. When I was in college, dance was very cool, and people, you know, went to it. The younger audience in the last 10 years has a 50% decline in dance. We talked a lot about education, but education is a reflection of the society. It's a reflection of the culture. I think even though we're preaching to the choir, I think there's some sinners in the choir, so I think that they could use a sermon. If I could make any change, it would be as to media coverage of the arts. The media tells us how to see the world beyond our own personal experience, and they tell us what's important. We know what's important: politics, sports, money, entertainment, weather, food, entertainment scandals, and maybe, I don't know, health. You'll see more coverage of a minor highway in the course of the year than all of the arts combined. We live in a society right now, if you went to college freshmen, and I would challenge anybody to do this, and ask them to name a single living poet, dramatist, I mean, a single living American dramatist. You know, after the death of Arthur Miller, none. Poet, painter, sculptor, choreographer, dancer, opera singer, classical musician. Gets worse. Physicist, biologist, mathematician, theologian, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing. They could name hundreds of ballplayers, hundreds of pop stars. And so the media does not create this sort of thing. How do we increase jazz audiences? This is how pathetic the answer is. Over the objections of our government lawyers, we did a little 60-second bio with a little donut saying, and tonight, you know, at the Pepke Auditorium, and we do a little biography of Dave Brubeck, of Herbie Hancock or whatever. The attendance doubles on this pathetic little entry into public discourse. So we need to have the media acknowledge that this is something of some importance.
Can I quickly add, because the question was what can we do about it? Yeah. One thing we can do about it is get more and more businessmen to understand the value of the arts, to build it intrinsically into the way in which they use their business, display it, and encourage rising young executives that embracing this stuff is going to make you rich, rich in every dimension.
Can I just throw in to Bob's question? I think opera and music theater, underlying the thing about surtitles and Disney, is that they are narrative forms, and they combine narrative and music in a very powerful way. And just to glimpse a topic that we won't get to, I think classical music in the 20th century lost track of a narrative element. And high modernism, of which I was definitely a part myself, but high modernism in music disconnected itself from its audience in a profound way. And the narrative elements that you see in musical theater and opera are a restorative element there.
Please.
Good morning. I'm Jan Greenberg. And if we study the development of art education in the United States, let's say from the late 19th century on, we know that the purpose of teaching arts in the classrooms, in the public schools, was not to encourage aesthetic perception, not for creativity, not even to develop good audiences, but to make good citizens. That was the purpose. Of course, the arts education has changed, and in the last 25 years, those of us who've been involved in it have found that we're constantly doing studies to prove to the schools that the arts increase basic skill learning. And it's been a tough one. But having gone around to many schools over the years, I've discovered that the most important thing is teacher training. And what I would like to ask you, Michael and Dana and Alan, is there any specific programs that you all have funded or put together in your individual arts programs that have been for teacher training and have had some kind of impact?
Well, yes, we have. Most arts groups bring students in to plays or to concerts, and we realize that that students, while it's fine to come in, just come in, that some preparation was helpful. And we then went into the schools, and we found out that the problem with the schools was that when we would come into the schools, the teachers would leave and have a cigarette, that they kind of thought that this was their lounge time, and so there was no follow-up. So we said, we're not going to do this anymore, and we go into every DC junior high and high school for free. We said, we're not going to do this anymore. We're not going to have this program, which we call Text Alive, until the teachers, we started working with the teachers, and we found out that the teachers were so dispirited. They felt that they couldn't teach, first of all, Shakespeare, he was a dead white European male, and that there was so much antagonism to doing it. So we said, all right, and they didn't know how to deal with their students. So we said, all right, we're going to have a program. We're going to actually pay for you to come. It was 10 weeks. They came once a week for 3 hours. We worked on how to look at Shakespeare in a slightly different way, to see how you could relate themes, how you could do theater games, how you could make projects for students so that they would, for instance, they were going to come see Romeo and Juliet, to explain a sonnet to them and ask them to find a way to write a sonnet. We were doing Othello. We asked the teachers to see the handkerchief means so much in Othello. If they had to make a handkerchief, what would that handkerchief be like? How you could create modern expressions. We did Romeo and Juliet. How you could talk about teen suicide in your class in relation to Romeo and Juliet. And the teachers began to see that they could be using theater games, improvisation, dialogue, in a way that they'd never done before, and make it interactive with the kids. And that program has become very successful, and now they're maybe, you know, we've had about 300,000 kids and about, you know, 200 teachers go through this. So it became really important, but we found out that the teachers needed to be re-inspired in some way to feel that they could go in against their administration and say there was a reason. I'm sure you've done a lot.
Folks, yeah. We have time for one more comment or one more question. Which would it be?
Well, I think Dana
knows
about
one each.
Well, what I was going to say is if Congress gave us $10 billion tomorrow to put arts education in middle schools and high schools, we wouldn't be able to do it because we'd have to recreate all of the infrastructure that's been torn down over the years. And so we'd have to both train the teachers, establish a successful pedagogy, et cetera, et cetera. So one of the things we're trying to do actually is exactly the issue that Michael talked about, is before we even train the teachers, we have to train the administrators. So we've been doing these large statewide training sessions where we bring in the entire infrastructure of the state high school system and middle school systems. We have to bribe them to get them there. It's a pathetic thing. And we have the best people in the country go there and talk about what arts education can do, what it can't do, what works, what doesn't work, where do they go, especially in their own community, to the arts organizations to find the expertise that they can borrow, how to get funding and do things like that. But we've had to essentially begin almost at a conceptual level to make any change at all.
And by the way, a child will be left behind if they don't have arts in their life.
And may I just say something briefly to that same point? I was part of a program called the Boston Music Education Collaborative, which was the Boston Symphony, GBH, public radio and
one
TV.
One of the best in the country.
And the New England Conservatory. But the program foundered on the chaos of the Boston public schools. And it goes to that instrumental versus intrinsic argument. And the question, it had this at its heart, I think. We do need professional arts educators. And it can't just be you can teach social studies by using music and theater. It has to be someone who really lives in the arts, I think. And then it's exactly what Michael said. It should be not about the Mozart effect, not about you can read better if you listen to music. It should be about you can dream and you can be creative and every person can have that experience, and that's what the arts education should be about.
Folks, and you two in particular, I apologize. We have another group coming in. My obligation is to clear the hall. I want to thank our panelists and leave you with one last brief thought. It is held that Galileo suggested that mathematics was the vocabulary God used when writing the universe. That may be so. I am certain that she was listening to Mozart when she did it. Thank you very much.